Thank you. Thank you all for the invitation and the organizers and a splendid job. And can I be introduced to Rudy?
Yeah.
Rudy. Hi.
Yeah.
Hi.
Good to meet you.
We have emailed several times. And I, yeah. All right. There we go.
He's the only one who looks like Rudy.
From the smile, yes. All right. So I thank you for the invitation, and I want to premise the presentation with the following warning that I heard you talk about theoretical physics, but this is a little different in the sense that my interest, as I will describe it briefly at the beginning, has been in a field that arouses smiles throughout the world, which is, can you bring the marketplace and theoretical physics together in a way that young PhDs studying the Casimir effect can get jobs in the field in which they studied, which wasn't my personal fortune when I graduated. So the question here is, do we have something such as, for instance, imagine historically the invention of the transistor, semiconductors, the semiconductor industry. Imagine that you are in the late 30s or early 40s. It's a fantastic problem, but can you make an industry out of it that changes mankind for the better? So there is a, well, you know, I got math, don't worry, you know, but the question is, where are we going with this? And that's really what drove me from the beginning. So this is not for marketing purposes, and I don't want your money, but I just want you to know that I am, as we all know, physicists have got plenty, right? So, but I want to give you a description of a small company that is trying to take dispersion forces to the marketplace. And if you think that I am alone doing this, of course you think of the Gecko glue, for instance, recently, that I'm sure you all have heard or discussed about it earlier on in the school here. So the question here is it possible to create marketable, useful things out of dispersion forces? And of course, to do that, we need to understand them. We need to just do the same thing that we are all doing already in terms of studying them. But there is now an additional dimension, many dimensions actually. There is the dimension of the marketplace. So I wanted to understand how I got to this. First of all, I was in 96 to 99, I was a scientist, but in reality a navigator at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech, which is a glorified air traffic controller, basically, for only you do with the planets. And one day, my supervisor took me up the hill on a fascinating assignment, which was, he said to me, at the intersection between navigation, relativity, and astrophysics. And that's got to be interesting. I mean, imagine that. Navigation and relativity rarely come together. So what that was about was the Interstellar Probe project, which was explored in the late 90s by NASA to answer the question as to whether one can take a spacecraft to within, say, 10 light years, a metric ton of stuff, and do a typical mission out there. What would it take? And so I came into contact with some interesting personalities, but one of them being Robert Forward. I don't know if you've heard the name, but some people are addicted to Robert Forward. He was a futurist, a science fiction writer. But he came out of College Park Department of Physics, out of John Webber's group for gravitational wave detection. So a very respectable person in any other way. But his eclectic interests were fascinating, and one of them was the Casimir effect. So you see here, article in Physical Review B about the dreadful words that we'll need to talk about, extraction of energy. Of course, there is no violation of energy conservation. Don't worry about it. The energy is already there. But I was exposed from the beginning, therefore, to the fact that the Casimir effect is not a curiosity. It's not a something, what is it called, a counterintuitive consequence of quantum electrodynamics. Is that what Schwinger called it? Or a weak force. To me, from the beginning, it was something useful. And the reason that we talked about it on the Interstellar Pro program was for nanotechnology reasons, mainly. Is it useful for anything? Are we going there? And the other place where I had heard about the Casimir effect before getting interested in it is a very weird way. And I don't know how many of you have heard about the Golay cell. You know what a Golay cell is? This was the first way that infrared radiation was being detected in the 1930s. So you basically have a small container with air, and you let the radiation hit it, the gas expands. It flexes a small membrane, and so you have a capacity detector facing it, and you can detect radiation that way. It looks like, you know, next to Tutankhamen, you know, in terms of what we do today, needless to say, for infrared radiation. But that was what used to be done at the time. And Golay, by the way, went on a very successful career in computer science, so you may have heard the name Golay. If you've heard the name of Golay in computer science, it's the same guy. And Italy in the late 70s, you know, was giving me the opportunity to explore a Golay cell, but instead of working at a room temperature, it would have worked at 4 degrees Kelvin. And the idea was to somehow apply it to a 3-degree background radiation detection for cosmology. And so I remember, this is Carlo Cosmelli, who is now a full professor at the University of Rome in the gravitational detection lab, who told me these words that always remained with me for years. Be careful when you put the membrane in the plate. They should not be too close, because there is a thing called the Casimir effect. And he left it there with no further explanation. So that's how I heard about it. Now, all this, usually, when I speak about these things, often the theoretical physicists, of which I've known a few, sometimes feel offended. Now, this is vulgar. Let's say it. That's what you're thinking. He's talking about money. He's talking about applications. You know, this is beneath us, right? But who was Henry Casimir? Casimir was not. Casimir didn't accept the chair of theoretical physics at Leiden when it was offered to him. He had a standing offer for his entire life, and instead he remained at Eindhoven working at the Philips labs, and he became the vice president of Philips, making such statements as the one that you see up there. So this man was far from considering theoretical physics as abstract or useless. So that was more or less all that I wanted to hear. And this is an interesting slide that I have lifted off of their own website, talking about historically what happened. And you see, this is the period 45 to 70. He died, I think, in 2000, right? So this is 30 years before his death. And applicable after 60 years. So they were wondering about it. Now, this is another thing that I found inspiring. You've got to understand that a navigator at NASA needed a lot of philosophical reasons for doing this. I really had a conscience problem at leaving NASA to go do this. Is it crazy to go find economic application, financially viable applications of the Casimir effect? And so I just wanted to be reassured that somebody else has said the word vacuum engineering. And this is T.D. Lee, maybe you've seen his textbook, you know, talking about exactly that. That those are his words, possibility of vacuum engineering. So in 1999, I left the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and I started this company called Interstellar Technologies with the idea that I was going to do good science. I wasn't going to do crazy stuff, you know, and you have heard, you know, extraction of energy out of the blue sky, and you know, there are all the kinds of science fiction things that you've heard about. What I wanted to do was a real company with real products based on that. And as I did my research, this is all primeval by now, of course, you know, but I wanted to find out who for the first time had done the Casimir IV, the dispersion forces, in the unretarded case for silicon, and that was crap many years before. And this is still a very modern experiment. We are very heavily involved with a modern version of this experiment that is the first attempt to modulate the van der Waals force. Of course, Arnold and his group in Germany did something that, in my opinion, is not spoken about too much today. They were the first to wonder whether it is possible to change the Casimir force, for instance, by illumination. We now take it as some kind of a cutting-edge achievement, but this has been done in 1979. The idea, I find it absolutely genial. And it is the starting point for what we became interested in at Interstellar, which is the question of, can you then make engine cycles out of devices based on the Casimir force? Your car works in the same way. Four-stroke engine works because you can change the pressure in the cylinders. So can we make machines out of that? So now the artist of the group, unfortunately, had too much time on his hand, and so he invented this. And I need to apologize to anybody who is involved with the National Institutes of Health for exposing you to this shameful material. But so the artist in question, who has big computers and stuff, basically wanted to explain: can we make ourselves useful to the rest of mankind? Is it possible that there is a disease out there that we can treat by nanorobotics or any kind of nano engineering that we can do, and it'll work based on the Casimir force? And I would love for you to give me feedback about this. Those of you who know how the human body really works, so that I can feed it back to the artist in residence, and he'll know that he was completely useless. And
I think that it would work better if the arms of that thing were colored blue.
Blue? Oh, okay. That's easy to fix.
You can see the red thing, I guess.
You're right. Yeah. Well, that's he would.
That's a considered opinion.
He would understand. He would understand that, Professor. Yeah. That is a. What is then the approach that we had decided to take over the year? This is a company that has been around almost 10 years. So the question is, once you want to start a company and you want to add value to the investment that you have received, and you want to do this with the Casimir effect, you got to have a plan. And fortunately for me, this is not just me. We have one only of everything, but it is very good. So I have patent attorneys or corporate lawyers and whatever, mainly lawyers. It seems like it's only lawyers, really. But the plan here was that, as any company does, for instance, in biology, biotechnology, there is an issue of intellectual property. So we got to work securing the intellectual property that we thought was important. But then we started doing some research in areas that we deemed important. So on the one hand, there is a question of real. I'm sorry that I realize now that it is kind of small there, but it is obvious that the Casimir force calculations done by means of the analytically solvable cases is insufficient for industrial purposes. You need to go well beyond that to be able to characterize a device. So the numerical problem became rapidly an interest. Another issue that, in my opinion, in all humility, has been neglected is, and I had discussions about this in Leipzig last year, the question of electrostatic calibration of Casimir force measuring experiments. I have heard that the highest levels, such statements as, you can go to an undergraduate book and you find the force of attraction between a charged sphere and a conducting plane. And that's how you're going to calibrate your device, which is more or less what Arnold and his group did, only they did it in the case of plane conductors facing each other. Is that statement true? And you might say, well, are you saying that electrostatics is wrong? No. What I'm saying is the idealized version of that equation, the solution that you're going to find in your textbook, applicable to calibration? So we've done a series of experiments, initially concentrating on the Arnold experiment, which is a conducting mirror with a dielectric disk on it. And we're just measuring the capacitance of these two plates facing each other to see if it is the book value, basically, that you would expect. And this seems, again, a vulgar experiment, because what does it matter? But in reality, you find out very quickly that idealized solution is true only in very extremely idealized conditions. So now that you often will hear characterizations of the results of experiments about the Casimir effect based on this calibration, and consequences are being drawn about whether the Lifshitz theory correctly describes or not what's been observed. But I hear precious little about a real solid criticism of the electrostatic calibration that is behind that in a way or another. You're going to have some calibration about it. So this is, again, another ignoble enterprise that we are engaged in trying to figure out for both plane and sphere whether the calibration has been done correctly throughout time, basically. We then have, and I'll show you some more graphics of that, applications then that we are considering. In the case of the Arnold experiment, it is a very genial approach. It is a dynamic approach in which the Casimir force is measured by using a microphone. And in fact, Milani talks about it. He praises Peter Milani in the Quantum Vacuum book. You know, that approach is very interesting. You basically attach a small dielectric disc to the membrane of a microphone, and then you bring within range the sphere, for instance, the typical spherical sensor that you want to measure, and you make that distance change in time. Of course, this is a very familiar strategy from, you know, in other, especially with more recent MEMS applications of the Casimir force. But it goes all the way back to the measurement of potentials, contact potentials in metals. And so these people basically put a microphone under vacuum, and from the vibration of that membrane, again suitably calibrated, they measure the Casimir force. This was in 1972. It was following that that Arnold and company decided to then change the sphere that's facing the dielectric disk with silicon and illuminate it. And they were able to detect for the first time variation of the Casimir force dependent on radiation. What we want to do is something different. It's apparently similar when you look at it, but it is radically different. The question, what Arnold and others have been doing has been to change that gap artificially, for instance, with piezo actuators. And by changing that gap at a frequency that coincides, for instance, with the resonant frequency of the membrane, you get a response. Our question is it possible to keep them both at rest? Illuminate the silicon so that you have a carrier density that depends on time, and then actuate the membrane because the Casimir force is changing periodically, not because the gap width is changing. Now that's what I would call a demonstration of accretion. Okay, so far, most of the experimentation that you've seen imposes that change from the outside by using piezo actuators, basically. So that's an application. The question then...
I just want to make sure what's fixed and what's not fixed in your experiment, the thought experiment. So you're fixing the distance,
right?
Yet measuring the force as it changes, as you flow material between the plates.
Right. So if
So if
I have a lens here and I make this is my silicon deposition. Okay. Oh, thank you. Let's say this is my silicon deposition and this is silica. In their case, they just had basically silica in there. This gap, I can make it change periodically at high frequency. In their day, what they used to do, they used to glue this lens to a loudspeaker. And by giving an input to the loudspeaker, they cause this thing to vibrate. So S would depend on time. This is a microphone membrane. It's got a resonant frequency of its own. As it vibrates, you can measure the Casimir force that way. So the change in gap width is imposed from the outside. Technologically, what I would like to have to be able to claim that I have a device actuated by Casimir force manipulation is that this change is not imposed on the outside. For instance, they are both fixed. But I put radiation on the silicon, and that power is a function of time. The effect, in principle, should be the same. Casimir force can be made to change quite drastically by acting on the carrier density. And so you should still get this membrane to vibrate, but nothing is moving, which is different.
You have some kind of piezo to measure the change in
the
while you're keeping the distance fixed.
Because the microphone.
The microphone has got its own, it's a capacitive sensor. So you're going to have the electronics here, the capacitance of the membrane, and some facing plate. Yeah, sure. Yeah, This ends up moving. This ends up moving as it always does, but not because the gap is changing as a consequence of the fact that the lens is vibrating due to the vibration imposed on it by the loudspeaker, for instance. But these are both fixed, and any change, I mean, eventually the gap changes because this thing is vibrating, but that's not what's driving the vibration of the membrane. What's driving the vibration of the membrane is that the Casimir force becomes a function of time. Yeah?
How can they measure the distance with time?
In any of these experiments, there were, and in fact, you may have seen that in the beginning when I was, I can go back a second. So if I push P, it goes back, right? No, too easy. Here we go. So you can see here, light, okay? This light, well, you cannot see it. You're too far, probably. But what the distance between the silicon and the silica disk that is mounted on the microphone membrane is measured interferometrically by means of Newton's rings. And I'll show you some pictures later of that. Of course, that's not the only way to do it. But it was a very cool way to do it, though, at the time, because you're inside of a vacuum chamber, so there are some additional complications. So, yeah.
How do you cope with the temperature? I mean, if you put in light, I mean, this thing heats up.
Yeah, and in fact, the funny part is that if you do that, it becomes a glycel, doesn't it? That's what it wants to do. So the way that you can cope with it, and in fact, Arnold, even they thought about it at the time, what you do, you chop the light at very low frequency to see if you get a signal that depends on that.
Okay.
Realistically, that kind of light, this light is not the light that changes the Casimir force, okay? That will be coming from here in their experiment, but it's an additional thing that is not in this diagram. But that light, technically, you could remove everything. And you just shine light right onto the membrane, and you're going to get a signal, booming signal out of it. Radiation pressure, you're going to get the tension in the membrane, depends on temperature, all kinds of stuff. So this is a delicate experiment. And in fact, I've seen that you've had here Professor Mohideen that has come over. Right. So he has that. He faces very similar challenges, only at the AFM head, because you still can have radiation pressure, all the kind of contamination. So same thing, yeah, sure.
So if you are varying the force, the frequency close to the resonance frequency for the membranes, and you will be extracting energy from the vacuum?
No. You're going to be extracting energy from the beam of light that has caused that change. And what I would like to say about that is that, because I mean, I've had to sit down my lawyers and give them a lecture about the conservation of energy so that they don't go around saying things to people. But now they know better than to say you're extracting, it's a forbidden word in our company, the extraction of vacuum energy. However, there are some interesting...
when you were exciting, I guess you're exciting electrons from...
Yeah.
Okay. What's the lifetime of the electrons when
well, that very much depends on what kind of semiconductor you got.
Yeah.
Because if you have pure crystal silicon, you can have 1 second of lifetime, right? I mean, it could be infinite.
Yeah.
But in this case, in particular, I think it's like 10^-4 seconds is the lifetime. Yeah. So, but it's got to be. There is an important interaction between that time and the natural resonant frequency of the membrane, obviously. Because if you want to, if the response is too slow, then you're not going to be able to excite the membrane. So anyway, okay. We've seen that. I wanted to just say one more thing here, because I mean all these things will come back later.
And typically, how many electrons do you? How much are you? exciting. How many electrons are you putting?
The calculations that I will give you the reference for go from a very low, let's say 10 to the 13 electrons per cubic centimeter, all the way up to 10 to the 20th. That depends very much on what kind of doping you have, if it is doped. So there is calculations, and both calculations and experiments. In Arnold's case, and in ours, we are studying this with undoped silicon. So there isn't any dopant. But I think that Umar has done it with phosphorus, if I remember correctly. He's doped the amorphous silicon with phosphorus, if I remember correctly. So you can get to 10 to the 24th electron per cubic centimeters. You know.
That changes the interaction by what percentage?
By an order of magnitude. I mean, it's pretty remarkably high.
Metallic.
It becomes a metal, yeah. Metal. So you're going basically from a dielectric to a metal in terms of intensity, yeah. It's a very dramatic effect. And I wanted to mention, because somebody, I don't know names, I'm sorry about that, but somebody was talking about extracting the energy. The application that we are pursuing of this is in a niche market of low-level electronics that is called energy scavengers or energy harvesters. And these are basically, there's a big school about this at MIT. I don't know if here anybody's from MIT, but they basically wrote the book originally on capacity microphone I was telling you before, and you shake it, and you're going to cause that membrane to vibrate. All of a sudden, you're making energy. You didn't have it before. You know, you're getting an electric signal. So the question that they're asking is, if I got this device now attached to your legs, how much power can I make? And you will be amazed to know there is exhaustive literature on energy production through strike of heels of humans. The idea being that something is coming out of there and some electronics can be driven by that little power. So the question is, for instance, if you have a battery connected to a sensor that is measuring pressure in your eye, how often would you like to change that battery if you are the patient? Probably never, right? So the question is it possible to avoid any change of battery, but simply because your head is moving, the temperature in the body is changing, or anything else that changes, can you extract energy? So that's called energy scavenger. If you go to the internet, you're going to find a respectable field of engineering called energy scavengers or energy harvesters. So what we are pursuing is an energy scavenger based on the Casimir effect, in which the additional complication, and I'll say some more about that later, is that you don't only have two objects attracting each other, but you have actually, it's called a triple release structure, basically. You also have here your traditional positive and negative plate charged, and this plate, it could be the membrane of the same microphone we were talking about, moves back and forth. That changes the distance between these charges. So it's an undergraduate electrostatics problem, right? That you're basically transforming the mechanical work done by the Casimir force into electricity that you can harvest. So the harvester part is the same as any other energy scavenging device based on capacitive effects, of which there is an exhaustive literature. What's different is what's moving it, what's driving it. Typically, it's vibrations, but that commits the entire device to vibrations. The Casimir effect allows us to do it with anything else in addition to vibrations that causes the Casimir force to change. It could be changing illumination. It could be cosmic rays. It could be, you just think, whatever a semiconductor does that causes a charge carrier density to change, that becomes the pool where you're going to go get energy. And I'm telling you that if you want to know some numbers, I mean, the numbers are extremely small. You know, 10 milliwatts is considered a goal in this field. However, there are things like accelerometers can be driven on that power. So if you now have a device, and I let your imagination run wild here, but you have a device that once you build it, you don't want to open it anymore, and there are those things out there in the world, okay, then how can this thing get energy? Vibrations, change of temperature, anything. You know, so there is a market for these things. And of course, the Casimir effect here is useful because if you use that instead of just vibration, you can probably have three or four or five different things that are, that you can harvest energy out of. And now to answer the provocative question about extracting energy from the quantum volume, there, remember?
Joe.
No, it's okay. I wanna. Let's just deal with that. So the thing is, first of all, my company is not in the business of doing that because you cannot make a company. You know, if that is even possible, we now know it's very hard. So investors wouldn't be happy with that. However, we do have another interest, which is the issue of testing stochastic electrodynamics as opposed to quantum electrodynamics. And I don't think for a second that we're going to find that SED is valid over QED. However, it has an interest in principle to know how such an experiment can be made. And as you know very well, yeah.
So what is basically the difference between stochastic electrodynamics and quantum?
Well, in stochastic electrodynamics, you go to the Maxwell equations, mm-hmm. and you add a term, and you say when Deucalion made the world, or Zeus, whatever, many years ago, he made a classical field that permeates the whole universe. And it's a classical field which, on Lorentz invariance, is going to end up having the same frequency dependence omega cubed as the quantum zero-point energy field. The difference, one would say, is that in the classical case, because that there is that cubic frequency dependence, it's not a thermal spectrum. Thus, you can have, in principle, exchange of energy with this classical field. If it is quantum, it's the ground state. You can't. Right.
You can presumably relate the two with the fluctuation dissipation theorem, but it would take weird properties out of it.
Yeah, and in fact, I will not even say that it is not possible to suggest experiments. In fact, in Milani's book, there are a couple of experiments that seem to suggest, in principle, that that is the case. However, as Lamoureux pointed out in a review recently, if you really try to prove that you can distinguish a classical field from a quantum field as pertains to the predictions on the Casimir effect, it doesn't seem to be possible.
This is a version of quantum mechanics? Or this is
it's an issue about whether quantum mechanics is even true.
But there was a combination of quantum mechanics by Bohm, which was based on stochastic.
Yeah. It's an old field. I mean,
it's Nelson Bohm type.
If you read, Boyer has written many articles on that, and so bottom line is, the way I understand it, there is no way to distinguish the two.
I think that it's known that it's a reformulation and not.
Yeah, it's fully equivalent to quantum mechanics.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, from the perspective that I'm interested in, the question here becomes whether you can extract that energy or not, if it even exists in a classical form. And it's a very interesting problem. In fact, I published a paper in which there is that difficulty. But
10 digits. Maybe you should
I think it's
come on. I mean, I think the it's not just one corner. You test the theory. I mean, you have the whole world of things that you would not test with Casimir effect QED. I mean, you have G-2. I mean, the best measurement you can have.
Yeah, that is another problem. Sure, and there are other ways.
If a competitor can get that, then we can talk.
The Bohm theory was supposed to replace, I think, non-relativistic Schrödinger.
Otherwise,
it wasn't a general substitute.
So we have found something that the theorists like in this room. I spoken for 30 minutes and there wasn't a word. But now we talk about stochastic electrodynamics and you guys are on fire. So you like that subject then, huh? Okay, good. I'm really interested in the sociology of the Casimir effect. That's fascinating. Okay. Well, there is extensive literature on the subject, which false or true that it might be. So my interest is in the following problem, that I published a paper in 1999 in which I calculated the Casimir force between semiconductors in relationship to these thermodynamical issues of engines. And there's a reference appears here somewhere at some point. And the bottom line is that if the Lifshitz theory is to be taken as is, then I was having a numerical conservation of energy issue. And so my guess is that when these two surfaces become very close to each other, I know that you are investigating spectra very carefully, so it'd be interesting to know what effect the fact that two surfaces are very close to each other has on the optical spectra. Because my guess, if I were to make a wild guess, I'd say that the spectra become modified as the two surfaces become close by exactly what it takes to make the whole problem go away. But I don't think that the calculation has been done. So that would be an interesting.
One way of looking at the Casimir and the Bowles is that it's due to the small changes in the frequencies of the modes due to the proximity. So presumably that would show up.
Yeah, but then you need to. But the problem is, it should. But then you need to couple the physics of the semiconductor to the physics of the Casimir effect, and that coupling I haven't seen satisfactorily. But it would be very interesting
to do. Roger French gave a very nice talk earlier this week where he was talking about dopants in the cavity. And the question whether the dopants move in and out during the interaction, or they're fixed, is there enough energy to pull the guys in?
Yeah, okay, and that is the kind of questions that we need to answer. Yeah. So the question, the reason that I'm interested in that is not for technological purposes, but because I think it answers a fundamental question about quantum electrodynamics. So this takes us, and Adrian, I don't know the time, I don't know anything at this point. How am I doing the time? Am I okay?
We're very bad at telling.
Okay, all right. I don't care.
We should be wondering if someone wants to move.
Sure, absolutely. So the artist here went wild again. This is the article that I was mentioning before, where I absolutely fell in love with Arnold's experiment on changing the Casimir force by means of radiation in semiconductors. It, as you know extremely well, no better than Adrian here, the Lorentz description. In fact, there is a bit in your book. It's a beautiful description of the place that the Lorentz model has in this in understanding these things qualitatively. But then you need to move forward. And so what I wanted to do was to find the best possible description without having to go to a bank of data, which I understand is what you are doing very well right now. I wanted to have, because I mean at the industrial level, what you would like to have is a few parameters that describe the performance of a device. And so I went to this description that I think up to this day is probably one of the best models for crystal silicon. And you also have the reference for there. There are some errata in the articles that they wrote, but I corrected them in my paper. So here, these are the questions that we were asking, and of course, you know this, so I can tell the artist that you saw it.
What changed in the second term? I'm just trying to think this
where it's. So the thing here is, this is of course the free charge here. So now here, what they did. Chu and colleagues there, they basically, I'm trying to figure out if this is a fundamental way or not. Mathematically, it seems like it's acceptable. They have a very good description, but the bottom line is that there is, you know, the science of analytical fitting of data by means of equations that are Kramers-Kronig consistent.
Yeah, and so actually asking a simpler question. I know how to square a quadratic. I can see downstairs looks okay with different.
Oh good. No.
what's upstairs?
Upstairs there is a phase. Yeah, there is a phase that you need to have in there to do the modeling better.
But epsilon is real.
But you have to have a real function. It has to be monotonically decreasing. So your denominators take care of the decreasing part.
That's correct.
But where is this I coming in here? I don't
know. So the.
You're picking up on that, yeah.
Yeah,
SJ
must be
integer,
right?
It has to be.
No, I can get it.
I'll. Maybe it's rather not FJ times.
But you need to understand that the. I'll. Yeah, I have a few papers here. Yeah. I'm trying to find that.
Keeps it real.
Yeah. Well, FJ could be complex.
That's if I found. If I brought it.
You want to give yourself a real headache. I'll buy the aspirin, but that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I mean these are. That's why I love Mathematica and other stuff, you know. But for these things, here we go. In the article that I've given Adrian, there is a table that calculates what the best SJs are for crystal silicon. Then there is, of course, in their articles a rationale for what this is doing. And you need to understand that in principle, these expressions are wrong quite often in the sense that they are only in part Kramers-Kronig consistent. And the question is, how good are they? because the strong point of the Lorentz model is that it is Cramer's Kronig consistent. These are not. So you're gonna find yourself in situations in which, for some psi, epsilon could be just slightly negative. It could happen, and instead of being positive all the time.
Use this for the computation of forces, and that is a complex function as an imaginary part. Didn't you get an imaginary force out of it?
Right. So we know that these ought to be real, and that's what we're going to use. We're going to consider its imaginary part an error, and it works very nice actually. It's because it's not that bad considering. Now there are other functions that are even better than this one. However, their derivatives are discontinuous, and there is again a vast literature on those. But I remain interested in there is one that has come out in the last 2 years, and I can give you the reference for that for gold, same kind of model as this. So my question, this is more of a question, is whether from the standpoint of the theorist, this kind of modeling has any room, or whether the raw data out of spectral banks are the way to go necessarily, or whether from my standpoint of industrial applications, am I getting in trouble if I use stuff like this as opposed to using those other, the raw data that are tabulated. Obviously, there are some advantages to this because eventually some of these parameters can be led back to some properties of the material. It makes understanding incredibly simpler compared to...
When you write in it, silicon, do you try to kind of express it in... Because in the irradiated silicon, obviously the Cramer's Kronig, you have to be careful.
Right.
So this would actually... If you just want to interpolate between the irradiated and non-irradiated, that's actually might be
right.
The most convenient way to go.
Yeah.
But then you have to make the parameters depend on the...
doping or something.
But they'll have to match correctly when you go to the equilibrium state.
Definitely that is true. And that leads us back to the question about what is the lifetime of the decay.
Right.
So if it is very short, then it's a good approximation. If it is long, then you're going to have problems. All this territory, frankly, is barely being explored right now. So that's a very good comment that you're making. I appreciate that. But don't we have the same problem also for the tabulated data, though? Because now, if the tabulated data depend on time, in practice,
right. I mean, in general, we all know the validity of Cramer's Kronig.
So, sure.
Again, it's the question of what kind of interpolation you want to do I've never seen your calculations. So
I can't say.
But I can see how it can be useful in that sense.
Yeah, and that's typically why these kinds of equations are used, is really more of an industrial application for purposes of optimization, for instance, of a particular device. There is, however, in the Physical Review, a very lengthy literature about the theoretical foundations that go at the root of this.
Maybe I can add another comment.
Sure.
I don't know if it's true or not, but there is this question of to what extent when you describe really, a system of interacting bodies when they are very close together, it isn't really, strictly speaking, a ground state situation, because you've done all kinds of integrations of things out, mm-hmm. out of the system. So I think there is some kind of a discussion of to what limit are you allowed to always assume that you are having this kind of really ground state and using all these properties.
So this would apply to the Lipschitz theory then, you're saying?
Well, mostly if you are interested in the end of either moving things, mm-hmm. or doing anything which puts you a bit out of the ground state.
Right. So that is important to know, of course, because some of these problems about, with consistency with the Lipschitz theory, energy issues appear when these planes are extremely close, almost unrealistically close. So maybe that explains why that's happening. So I'm making mental notes of all these things. I appreciate it.
So there are things like friction.
Sure. But that that would.
If you're collecting, you know, very small energy to begin with, how do you know whether what's lost in between is smaller than
right.
what you collect?
Right. So yeah. So there is an issue of energy budgets, but the that friction would depend on frequency, right?
Right. Relative so, velocity.
Right. Uh-huh. So that would be probably a way to distinguish it. All right. So. Let's see. What are you doing to me?
Next.
Here we go. All right, so now kind of a little bit of a quick status report. This shows a version of the modern Arnold experiment, in which we have the microphone membrane. This is the little circle. This bright circle is not on the membrane, but it's actually a silicon deposition on this lens that is facing it, and it's very close to it. The lens is positioned in ways that were not available at the time, of course, so we have piezo nanopositioners of all kinds. Light, when Arnold did it, they basically used some kind of a floodlight and just shone the whole thing, you know, as bright as they could. It wasn't very precise. Whereas now, with fiber optics, we can hit right into the center of that little dot, which is important, as I'm sure Umar explained, because if you don't hit into the dot, you're going to have leakage to the sides, and then you don't know if the signal is being caused by that light striking the membrane. This is the interferometric measurement of their distances. And this was the same dangerous artist's conception of the actuation of the membrane. And I wanted to mention that simply to say that another application that we are pursuing at the nanotechnology level is to interpret this membrane as an optical device, such as a mirror. And so this means now that its shape, its radius of curvature could be controlled by light. So perhaps here we have an element of Casimir force-driven adaptive optics that could be used at the nanotechnology level.
No, so there are extra complications here because of the shape change, because all the theory which you were referring to was derived of fixed shapes. And if you change shapes, then all kinds of complications arise.
I completely agree, and that, in fact, is the reason that we eventually realized that there had to be a numerical commitment, you know, to calculating Casimir forces in non-obvious geometries, because it is definitely the case that what you're saying is right. Yeah. Another observation that I might want to make here is, I think that Lamour always made that observation, is that Casimir force research, the experimental research, seems to be leading the theory at the moment. So I think that I never would have said this before, but it pays to do the experiment and understand what's happening and go there later, because it seems that in many cases, for instance, even in the measurements that Umar has made about Casimir forces in semiconductors, there is a discrepancy with respect to the Lipschitz theory. So I completely agree with you. There is territory to be explored there.
I don't think he ever uses an object which can change its shape.
No. He has just a little ball that moves in front of the device. Right. But in this case also, however, let me say that this is because the artist didn't do all that he was asked to do. But in reality, if you go back to the Arnold experiment, they had, and we also have, a piece of silica glued here that basically makes this into a cylinder that is equal to that one. So the rest of the curved membrane is far away.
Maybe weakly involved.
Yeah, it is weakly involved. It's maybe, you know, if the thickness is 3 micrometers here, it's basically out of range. But I appreciate your comment, and any literature you have on that will be appreciated. It's definitely a complicated problem there.
Even without the deformation, though, it's an interesting thing about how the guy is going to shift. The guy on the right wants to feel the force when you excite electrons on the left, basically.
So the interesting thing now is...
the economy of this thing, you're doing this exciting, it costs you some money.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to get some work back from pushing.
And the interesting part is that if you now have a ray of light that you split and you send half of it into this concave mirror and the other half you send it on that side, you have something like a switch here, like an optical switch, which is what I was trying to schematically describe in those figures there. There is a lot to be explored,
also,
but yeah.
Depending on the modes which will excite in September,
yep.
even so you have a piece which you think is yep. spacing, the other piece, depending on the mode, it can bend in all possible.
Oh yeah, in fact that even happens not only with Casimir forces, but it happens even electrostatically. You know, this device here, if you take this out and you put a plate in front of it and you do it electrostatically, that's the way that every capacitive microphone is calibrated. Okay, and so and there are equations, but and actually we did the first experiment on how a membrane with a cylinder glued to the center responds electrostatically to that excitation. And in fact, if you are not perfectly centered, you start seeing all these kinds of modes on the membrane. So that's, you know, so but it's good. This is good physics. I mean, it's very interesting too. And even the I think that there is an article by Maclay from years back on a one-dimensional, like a rod, for instance, deformation. And it's a very complicated problem, you know, because so imagine in two dimensions, it's even more complicated.
Yes. From the perspective of applications, what is the advantage of using the Casimir force as opposed to having charges on the two capacitors?
Well, yeah, the reason is that there are several. In adaptive optics, there is an issue of speed, the frequency at which you can update the image. Say that this is the mirror of a telescope or a small part of the mirror of a telescope. A fundamental limitation is how fast you can respond to the atmospheric turbulence and correct the shape of the mirror. And obviously, there is a case to be made that a computer that needs to send an electrostatic signal may end up being slower than a light beam that only needs to depend on the decay time of the free charge carriers in the semiconductor.
What's happening actually is charge on this and charge on that, not changing the net charge. So you modulate the electrostatic force.
Yeah, and that's how it's always done ordinarily today with adaptive optics. It's, you know, either that or they actually have pegs. You know, I mean, they push like pistons. You know, and yes.
I can think of one possible advantage of this way. But is anything that does things electrostatically is likely to produce fields that influence neighboring devices of a similar kind.
Well, that's a problem.
This would be a more
right.
isolated device.
Yeah, that's a problem also, you know, because there are, as you know very well, you know, defense applications that you don't want to have interference. Also, the electrostatic thing commits you to a conductor, whereas the Casimir force does not require it. So there are, again, it's a niche interest, but... there are some advantages in driving things with light instead of doing it electrostatically. However, I don't believe that you can make a very good case on the scale that we have today. This becomes a winning proposition when electrostatic approaches lose because the scale just becomes too small. And that is the real point right now with adaptive optics is that typically it can be done in the infrared. But if you try to segment this mirror in millions and millions of parts, and do that electrostatically, at some point you hit into technological limitations. Whereas, you know, this may be, just as nanotechnology may be driven by Casimir forces in the future, this is another application where that might happen.
Is this
happen.
Really going to be a Casimir interaction? Because normally if I have an atom on the left, which is excited in another atom in the ground state, then I get some, there's a resonant
yeah.
interaction, there's a resonant interaction because it's 1 over r cubed.
Right, so this is...
All, which is not at all.
Well, this is another sociological aspect of the Casimir effect. So is that not called the Casimir? Because, I mean...
I'm not an expert in nomenclature.
Maybe Casimir Polder. I mean, because it is in every book that the effect that you just described was studied by Thiruna Machandran and... yeah. Yeah, exactly. There is a yeah. So So the I don't know why I remember Tiruna Machandran, but I don't remember the other name. That's absurd. But anyway, so the thing is that it's the Sanskrit somewhere, you know, that I like. But they would refer to that effect in their text as it's not a ground state effect by all means. That's true, but they would call it a dispersion force nevertheless. We're not gonna resolve it here. But I think that the American Physical Society would be well advised, and maybe all the others, to get together in a room with a bunch of smart people and start naming things, because van der Waals forces and Casimir forces alone. There is an initial nomenclature that we all know how that one should be retarded and one should be unretarded, but if you look at it in the papers, people ask me all the time. So I don't know how to address it, but it's a very good point, you know. So
maybe for one atom it could be the case, but they're not all excited
But but I guess that the point there would be that, well, I guess that I don't want to feel free to rephrase your question. But
one atom in an excited state it will interact differently, of course. But in silicon, they don't excite them coherently. I guess so. So probably it would be translated into dielectric constant as function of time.
But that's a very good point, though. That's a very good point. Yeah.
To not belabor the point, but I still don't know what is in which situation would this be advantageous with respect to a charge module.
For instance, let's say that you are the telephone company, and you want your light beams to go on fiber optic, and you don't want if you are calling a family on a fiber optic, you would like to avoid having to translate the light signal into an electric signal to know that you're calling Pittsburgh instead of calling Los Angeles. Move the mirrors to direct the signal to the appropriate fiber optic, then go back to light. This would allow you to encode the information in the light beam by means of intensity, for instance. So it's a switch.
So if you had a solar cell instead of that piece of silicon, and you would put a wire on this side, on one on the other, you say that would be slower in some sense, or not as efficient as putting a piece of silicon.
Not as efficient. I don't know slower, because the physics is pretty close, you know. But I would say that it isn't the more efficient way to do it. Yeah, in my opinion, you see, when you really start sitting down and you start thinking, okay, I'm gonna have stuff here in not too many years, where this is gonna be 10 nanometers. Do I really want to have electric wires here? That it becomes just a fabrication issue at some point. But your example of the cell is very well taken and noted. So often, we always need to be careful because we are so enthusiastic about our field of study that we don't try to make this into an answer in search of a question. You know, really, it needs to answer a real technological issue. So appreciate the comment there.
Sense of what is the minimal power you can losses become.
In the Arnold experiment, they were using 0.1 watt per square centimeter. That's the typical number that they were doing. Which is not outrageously. Yeah. Okay, so now that we're bored with too many pictures, I wanted to just say something briefly, because I don't know where the lunch time is going here, but I wanted to say something about our commitment to the numerical study. And I've noticed that in this beautiful event, you've had also the MIT group, Rodriguez, is that the group at MIT that has done the numerical calculations of the Casimir force? Yeah. So I don't know, who came, do you know?
Steve Johnson.
Johnson came, right, okay. So, I've had an interest in that approach, which I call maybe this is even too long. I don't know what they call it, you know, IFGFC. But so this fact of it's fascinating that thanks to those two papers or three papers that they have written, now we have a method in principle to calculate the Casimir force that is based on using numerical approaches well known from classical electromagnetism. That is an incredibly good development. And my question is, you know, as you know, they make the choice there. They make some specific choices, and they say that they are not necessarily the choices you got to make. It's simply a matter of the recipe that you want to use for those particular calculations. I wanted to know how simple you can make it. So we know that we can go buy a box for FDTD, but can we do it just FD, just traditional finite differences with no additional complications? And there are issues of study of the error, for instance, of the numerical accuracy that are better handled within traditional finite differences. I also just have a question. You know, how can you make it into a small paper for the American Journal of Physics that some kind of undergrad, or there are some smart kids in high school these days, that you can do finite differences and calculate the Casimir force, not you know, without going into outrageously complicated mathematics. I mean, for instance, you could take the green function problem and invert it with relaxation methods instead of using matrix inversion. You know, just traditional relaxation methods that they can understand from experimentation in class. So there was a pedagogical issue, if you want. There was an issue of accuracy that I wanted to investigate. And then on the other side, on the other side of complicating it, there is the issue of FDTD having inherently the problem of curved boundaries as a difficulty. So I wanted to recycle their idea, bring it into the finite differences realm, and approach it in axial geometries so that you could do, for instance, the plane and the sphere numerically. And so this is, I will not offend you with explaining what this is, but I've basically taken all that and I've done it in one dimension, just as an experiment, basically. And in the process, I've learned an awful lot about discrete Green functions, about which there is precious little out there in the literature, apparently, but fascinating quantities. And so, of course, you get your answer. Now, I am more reticent about what this is. The paper was submitted to the Physical Review. It was favorably refereed, but they gave me some things to do, so it's not appeared in print yet. So it's been recommended for publication, but it's not published yet. So bottom line here, the question that I wanted to answer is it possible to take their procedure and calculate the Casimir force between two plates when the boundaries do not coincide with any grid point by means of the traditional finite difference method? And so all this works out fine in one dimension. You know, you find the analytical equation for the Green function, all this done, you know, with simple algorithms.
Stuff and the gray stuff.
So the gray, the black. Okay, yeah. Okay, this is a difference. This is another difference between the way that Johnson and his group did it was by imposed periodic boundary conditions in the calculations, and just because I am contrarian, I wanted to have it instead with. I wanted to imagine that there is a physical cavity that contains these objects, the two plates. So there is going to be, in this case, they have a periodic boundary condition error. In my case, there is what people would call a windowing error in fiber optic numerics. So these are two perfectly conducting boundaries that contain the system. And these are your two dielectric slabs. But this is a one-dimensional case, so you're going to get your typical 1 over S squared Casimir force, you know, for perfectly conducting dielectric slabs. So it's unphysical, you know, but this is basically an issue of proof of concept, of, you know, of the idea, and for which I felt free to use the Lorentz model. And so all this takes us to, in this case, remember that we are still looking at two dielectric slabs whose boundaries coincide with the grid points that I've chosen. I still haven't done the case of the grid points not coinciding with the boundaries of the slabs. But anyway, it all works out fine. So in black here, you get the expected Casimir force integrand that you will get from the analytical expression given whatever parameters you choose there for silicon. And here, what you see is the behavior of the integrand for as a function of the size of the cavity. And I mean, numbers are available on request. But what you see here, this one has a small cavity compared with the thickness and the gap width between the two slabs. And so you get the windowing error that I was referring to. This basically is saying that the two slabs want to attract each other. But because there are these two containers behind them, they also are attracted by those. So, and in fact, there is a beautiful figure to that effect in an old paper by Matt Lobb to the same effect. Now, my interest is, what happens if that's not the case anymore? And the reason that I'm interested in doing these kinds of things, obviously you don't really realistically, in one dimension, you just do the grid where, you know, to avoid the problem. But the thing is that if you now want to do complicated surfaces, you're guaranteed that you're not going to be able to have the grid point coinciding with, you know, unless you do an unequal grid, in which case the order of the accuracy is not as high. And so what I did, I went back to a couple of paper by originally this came out of a paper by Vassallo, working for Telecom in France, basically. And he was doing the same exact kind of calculation, you know, discontinuous boundaries for real time instead of imaginary time. And the question then is, up to this point, my difference equations are the same as usual. But now when I get over here, what am I going to do? Because these two points obviously cannot have the same, I mean, to zero, to the lowest possible order, you could try to average out what the difference equation is for k and for k plus 1. But can we do better than that? So they developed a very interesting system that I have recycled for Casimir forces, in which if the for instance, the potential here is described as a Taylor expansion. And once you write it in this manner, you can find its first derivative and derivatives to all order. And what you can do, this is going to eventually entail the multiplication of three matrices. You're going to write down the potential at point P, its Taylor expansion, in terms of the Taylor expansion over here. And you're going to write the potential over here in terms of the Taylor expansion over there. So the strategy is to connect these two points to these multiple matrix multiplications, which eventually you can use to extract the difference equations. And once you do that, you recover the same order that you would have had if the boundary had coincided with the grid point. And the problem is that because you have described the potential, you want to do this too. In fact, this paper became important in the history of fiber optic numerics, because in principle it allows you to do that to any order you want. Typically, you need to stop at second order, whereas in this case you can do this to any order, provided that you have higher and higher and higher derivatives. The problem is, and this came out for the first time with Vassallo's paper, and there was another person before him, but the name escapes me now. But anyway, we're talking about 1988, 1989, more or less. You need to start imposing boundary conditions not only on the fields, but also on their derivatives, of whatever order you want. And that also can be expressed in matrix terms. So what happens is you're going to have one matrix that takes you to point K, to the boundary, on the left side. This matrix will take you from the left side to the right side on that boundary. And then there is another matrix that takes you from there to point K plus 1. At this point, you're connected the two points, and automatically you get the difference equations. The problem, in fact, if you go to the literature for fiber optics, you're going to find that new numerical methods have been invented just to avoid the horrific algebra of finding these difference equations. And what I've done, I've just put everything into Mathematica, and it basically reads out the difference equations, and then you just use them. I mean, these are not pleasant to check, of course, but for instance, in this case here, the differential operator of the Green function in our problem, which of course has got imaginary frequencies, connects point K to point K plus 1 to point K plus 2. Remember that these two points, K plus 1 and K, are not symmetrical with respect to each other. There is a difference. So you also need to have point k plus 2. And then all these horrific algebra finds these CR factors here. And more or less up to this point, they coincide what Vassallo found, except for the fact that there are signs differences because of the frequency change.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
You see, you've got a one-dimensional system. So your fields are perpendicular to that?
Parallel to the surface.
The real technical problem of putting Maxwell's equations on a mesh comes when you've got inclination of the field compared with the boundary, because then you've got different boundary conditions for E and for D corresponding to perpendicular and parallel.
And the interesting part...
The real technical problem is not this this one-dimensional geometry.
Right.
It's when you've got the inclination of the incident wave vector on the surface such that it's not parallel or perpendicular.
And that is... That is correct. In fact, and interestingly enough, in their first paper, and there is a huge literature in fiber optics on avoiding that problem, exactly that you're saying. So there, you know, because there are cases in which one mode overrides all the others, semi-vectorial approximations are correct. So they avoid it in that case. I avoided it by definition. What you're saying is correct. However, interestingly enough, and I'll give you the reference. I mean, you may want to look at it. What they did, they introduced yet another matrix multiplication in the middle of the process. So whereas now we've had matrix multiplications to go from K to the boundary on the left, to the boundary on the right, to the other point, K plus 1, if it is tilted as you are describing, then they introduce a rotation and a change of coordinates. So there is another matrix, there are two more matrix multiplications. They basically straighten it out, and then they apply the boundary conditions by breaking down the field into, again, tangential and normal component in that frame of reference. And in that case, it works out. In fact, they've even done it in the case of curved boundaries of any slope. I don't find in their papers that they are using a computer algebra system, but it's beyond me that they would do that all by freehand, you know, but... they're much better than I am. I mean, I found that computer systems are so much... So it's exciting for me to use a computer algebra system to derive the equations that we are going to solve. But it is not a trivial problem, especially if you start going to fourth order, for instance. Imagine what happens in those matrices when you have the tilting conditions that you're describing, that there is this change of coordinates. And that change of coordinates is not just a geometrical feature, just as you're describing. That change of orientation affects the difference of the coupling of the two polarizations. So it's got a deep physical content. But anyway, so they call it...
How to tie it with the frequencies? I mean, I guess if you want to make this, refine the positioning of this thing, then... And you have to invert the matrix for any frequency, right?
Yeah.
So then I guess when the frequencies are small, you just pick you don't need this at all, right? Or do you...
That's a very interesting question, actually. It's actually when the frequencies are small or large, because, you know, you would suppose also that they become transparent for high frequencies. Right.
So both these...
Right. And in reality, it's not true. There are some issues for very high frequency and very low frequencies. For very high frequencies, remember that we are going to renormalize at some point. So you're going to solve the problem also with no slabs and subtract. And so that takes care of the high frequency issues. The low frequency issues remain a challenge. I mean, and the only way that I personally found that you can address them is by making the window big enough. Then all these problems seem to go away. But it is true that the inversion of the matrix for arbitrary frequency certainly is challenging. You know, if you want to do it for extremely low frequencies or extremely high frequencies, because if you look at the Lorentz model, it goes down only as 1/x², which is not fast enough for all the matrix elements to not diverge. So, I mean, there are some technical issues there, but it's... What I found more fascinating is that when you do the calculation for different windows, again, you recover here for low frequencies the windowing error that we were saying before, but the integrand does not go to zero for high frequencies. I don't believe that there is anything deep in that. It's simply that so in practice you need to cut the integral. Also, this is the integrand. This is the Casimir, what I call the Lifshitz integrand. So this is the function that if you integrate it, you get the Casimir force. Okay?
And the colors are...
So in black, you have the analytical behavior that we all know. And for different colors, you have different sizes of the window or different spacing of the net, basically. And so, interestingly enough, you can get here pretty. I mean, this is if you really look. If you cut it here, you're gonna get a Casimir force that is maybe within 5% or better than the original value. But there is this additional complication that you need to be prepared for the fact that this function goes crazy at very high frequencies.
Only for the energy or for the force?
For the force. So for the energy. For, excuse me. This is for the.
Well, then if you're just doing that, then there's a logarithmic divergence. And you have to have some reference system to pull off the logarithmic divergence.
The
because essentially you're integrating log of omega squared.
I'm assuming it's automatically
subtracted. I hope so. But if he's got maybe he's not. Maybe.
No, and in fact the interestingly enough, what I would expect here is what Johnson was saying also in their paper. They talk about that and they say that they simply by subtracting the same integrand in the case of an empty cavity, they get the same answer, but with improved convergence. Yeah.
I mean, I have worked on similar, related problems in a different context. The reference curve, the black curve, how was that calculated? I mean, just for two plates? Or
yeah, just for two plates with no windows
and with the electric. I'm coming from chaotic scattering theory, and you have in chaotic scattering theory, you have a system you really want to study, an open system, and you put it in a box. Mm-hmm. Then you have, if you are after a spectrum, let's say, it's the periodic orbits that determine it
right
between the obstacles. If you put it in a box and subtract an empty reference box, you have two further periodic orbits coming into the plane. The periodic orbits that are just for the reference box. Mm-hmm. I mean, hitting only the reference box. That is subtracted if you subtract the reference box. But you have also periodic orbits that hit the reference box and the obstacle, but have nothing to do with your problem. You have to kill them. And the way to kill them is give a small imaginary part that you first, you make a limit. You give a small imaginary part. You let the box radius go to infinity, then you will remove the magic part. Then you get the exact answer.
This
is Quine's formula that is behind it.
I would love to have a reference to that, or your name, or something. You know, that's very good. Thank you. Obviously, that will fix this problem because it will make the integrand.
I've studied that for in chaotic scattering scenarios where you can solve a bound system or a scattering system, and you do. If you put in a smoothing, it could be also smoothing. Either a magic part or smoothing, it does the job. And you have to adjust the smoothing to the size of the box. If you have a small box,
I am sure that they will fix it because that would translate into the integrand converging faster and they will fix the problem. So, yeah. Good.
You could have just one plate in your box, and that's it. And then you will be studying interaction of this plate with this side or that side.
Right. That's one way to do it. What I've done is also take the whole system, but then it doesn't do what you're saying. But let's say that the box is big enough. You can take these two plates. They don't have to be in the middle. So you can explore the whole range of behaviors and see how they what it does, which is basically what you're saying. Because if I'm over here and the other side is far, effectively, I have eliminated it.
The issue which he mentioned is there are trajectories which hit.
That is true. So that doesn't go away. Yeah.
Go away. If you just look at one plate and the box.
Very good idea. All right. Maybe we can stay in touch. David, I'd love that. Thank you. I want to hear more about it. Okay, here, this is the interesting enough that the calculation of the Casimir force for different positions of the plates, this is the error in some relative units, for when the two plates are positioned at integer or non-integer grid points. And what is very interesting about this behavior is that it gives back something that is already known in fiber optics electromagnetics in the numerical calculation, which is that when the dielectric plate is positioned exactly in between two grid points, the order of the accuracy increases by one. And that's what you're seeing here, that when they are at 160 or 159, 158, you have very small errors. But it goes to a maximum when they are separated by one quarter of the grid point. So it's a similar behavior that you would see in a fiber optic situation. Okay, and I'm almost done. I wanted to just conclude with my enthusiasm for this field of study and its enduring mystery. In fact, I believe that I corresponded the first time with Professor Prasigian and Rudy about my interview with Nature on the maritime Casimir effect and the discovery by me that there isn't such a thing. And the maritime Casimir effect was
not the neighbor.
We can talk about it over food or something, you know. But in this case here, it's absolutely fascinating for me to consider that there were people 24 centuries ago that were wondering about cohesion. And of course, these are very crude explanations in terms of hooks and in terms of some strange property. But you can see that once you have the atomistic theory, then you can start asking all kinds of questions. The question is whether you have an atomistic theory, even if only at the philosophical level or not. So provocatively, I put this place here. This is Assos on the Turkish coast where Aristotle went to teach. And he wouldn't have liked that, of course. I mean, he was not an atomist. Interestingly enough, Galileo made that well-known error, considering, you know, on the issues of cohesion. He says that I don't understand it, but it's got to be something on the outside of the water droplet that holds it together. It cannot be coming from the inside. And this is Newton's frustration in the introduction to the Principia. Fascinatingly enough, in the Stephen Hawking edition, the introduction is not there. Whereas you had to go get it in some other book. But if you find the introduction, you're going to see that Newton was very upset about it. And there is a long story there with Robert Boyle, who was lifting pieces of polished marble he would have a piece of marble with another piece of marble in a string under vacuum, that he had invented the vacuum pump. So lifting them like that and what it meant philosophically. So there is a very interesting question there. So I think that we are doing something that is fascinating, and I'm delighted of your patience listening to an industrial physicist in all humility talking to you about all this. And please let me have any feedback and look forward to learning something from you. Thank you very much. Well, there's a wedding at Caltech that is waiting for food brought by me. So, but anyway, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it. Same here. Thank you.
Well, I don't know what the time constraints are. There is
we have two talks then. 12:30.
12:30.
And two.
And 2 o'clock.
Oh my goodness! Yes, 12:30 is a real science start, and then 2 o'clock is something about newspapers or something.
But so all of you present here have been coming since August.
It's not science. It's about
Some shorter, some.
Okay. Anyway,
so will you be able to make loudspeakers that are more?
Well,
better than the best.
The problem is that if you can do this not in a vacuum, that's the problem. Because if you could drive the sound with light, all these issues that.
I mean, all of the static noise that you have.
Yeah, right?
No, yes. But you could dream of an optical computer, or also that you can make it, try it, optical. Right.
Yeah. So the question is, which one is better? You know, if it is a, is it a computing problem?
Well, optical transistors.